Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop, where we bring you all the news from Washington, D.C. that the government does not want you to know. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I used to work as an attorney in Congress, and I was really surprised by all the information that we had that was never conveyed to the American people. That's why I'm here on the air giving you the Inside Scoop. Our topic today, well, it's kind of a variety of things. One thing I do want to talk about is gas prices. Gas prices are over $2 a gallon now in most of the United States. They're the second highest, even when you adjust for inflation, in American history. And I want to talk about the proposal, the idea that neither Kerry nor Bush has, of possibly taxing them and raising gas prices even higher. And actually, it may surprise you, but I support that idea, and I want to talk to you about that. I think that it may be a good way to finally get us out of our dependence on foreign oil. But I want to talk about a lot of things today because, well, my guest didn't show up. You know, that's part of life as a radio host. You plan, you get all these guests all this time in advance. My guest was going to be Congressman Jim Turner. He's the ranking Democrat on the Homeland Security Committee, the most powerful Democrat in charge of Homeland Security. And he was going to come on and tell us about all the incredible defects in our Homeland Security system. And it's really important what he has to say, and that's why, even though he was unavoidably called away at the last moment today, he's very much agreed to be on my show next week, next Wednesday, same time, and I really hope you'll tune into that show because he has a lot of important things to say. And hey, you know, I understand. He's a member of Congress. He's the ranking Democrat, the most powerful Democrat on the House Committee, the Select Committee on Homeland Security. I understand that sometimes things come up and he can't be on my show, and I don't really blame him. But that leaves me with sort of a hole in my schedule today. So I want to talk about gas prices. I just thought about that sort of at the last minute. But I also want to talk about really, well, anything you want to talk about. I've now been on the air for about a year. I've been on radiopower.org for, let's see, about 2 months now. And it's really been interesting getting to know all of you on the other side of the mic here. You know, here I just sit here and I do my thing, and it always seems to get a surprise when I get a phone call or I get an email to comment at radioinsidescoop.com. It's always nice hearing from you, hearing different voices. And I guess this really came to my mind yesterday when I had conservative talk show host Brian Stiebel on the air. Now, Brian Stiebel is a conservative talk show host out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And when he went on and on and on without taking a breath, kind of filibustering, and it got so bad that at the end of the broadcast I had to turn down his mic. What was interesting to me is that there was a dramatic reaction from you folks. All my lines were full. All my email box was full. But basically, it was complaining. It was complaining that he wasn't letting me get a word in edgewise, and I needed to, turn his mic down because he wasn't taking a breath. He wasn't answering my questions. And it struck me, I guess, yesterday that, sitting here at the radio, when I hear you call, when I hear you email, you know, I usually like it. It's good. I want your interaction. I want your response. I really think it adds to the show, including and indeed and especially those of you that don't agree with me, because I really like to hear different points of view on the air. And what struck me is that a lot of times when I don't have callers and I don't have emailers, I think, oh, well, maybe no one's listening. It may well be the opposite. It may be the opposite. The show that seems to be everyone's favorite, at least those of you that have emailed me, told me, was the show where I interviewed George W. Bush. You can check it on my broadcast archive on my website at radioinsidescoop.com. It's a few weeks back where I interview the president and use his actual voice. Now, you know, it was a tape. I don't think I'm really surprising anyone by saying that here. But I got almost no calls to that show, and yet it's everyone's favorite. So I guess I need to learn that when you call in, it doesn't necessarily mean that you like the show. It may mean that you don't like the show. But I guess what I want to do today, in addition to talking about gas prices, and I do want to talk about the possibility of increasing the gas tax, which I know is a position that's not going to win me many friends, but I do support it. It's just in general about the show. Now, some of you have been listening to me for a couple months. Some of you have been listening to me for a year. Tell me, here's your chance to really ask me any question you want. Now, every other show I've done to date has been on a particular topic, and we've kept the discussion to that topic. But, hey, you know, my guest didn't show up, but I also think it gives me an opportunity to really hear from you. Tell me, what shows did you like the most? What didn't you like? Tell me why. I try to do a variety of different things here, and I really appreciate your feedback. You know, I've done everything from have all kinds of guests giving interesting scoops on what's going on in Washington and really letting you know what's going on inside the Beltway. I've had people who I disagree with, college Republicans, members of the administration, conservative talk show hosts, and I argue with them. I even, when I'm, a lot of people's favorite show, I think, was when I argued with the guy from Focus on the Family on gay marriage. A lot of people like that show. What shows do you like? What don't you like? You know, I even did one, well, I don't know if we can call it a musical or not, but I even sang on air once. You might want to hide that archive. It's the show How Do You Solve a Problem Like Scalia? And I've tried to do a variety of stuff, but I'd really like to hear from you. What do you like? What don't you like? Is there a topic that I haven't addressed yet that you'd like to see me address? You know, I have lots of sources in Washington, having worked on the Hill a number of years and having lots of sources, not just in the Democratic Party. I actually got some administration officials that leak me stuff, and I'm very happy to have them. And not just in the legislative branch, but, you know, if you want to talk about the courts, I'm a constitutional lawyer. I certainly can talk about anything the courts are doing. And certainly I'm happy to talk about, well, I don't know if I'm happy, but I will talk about George W. Bush and all the things the executive branch is doing. That's part of my role. That's what I give to you. But, you know, if there's, maybe there's a topic that I raised over the past couple months that you didn't get a chance to respond, or you heard on my archive, or you thought about it, and you really never had a chance to tell me what you think about, oh, any of my topics, you know, whether it's dealing with Iraq or dealing with the deficit or abortion or medical care or genocide in Sudan, what's going on in Israel, Gaza, the Patriot Act, you name it, here's your chance to, you know, fill in the gaps. Ask me a question. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. And, you know, some people tell me they like when I tell stories about what I do. For example, I wrote part of the Patriot Act. Now, not the bad part, folks, the good part. I can tell you about that. Or, indeed, the role I played in Gore v. Bush, the role I played, indeed, in challenging the 2000 Florida electors. Or just what it's like sitting on the House Judiciary Committee, sitting on the House Homeland Security Committee. How do things work in Congress? Because I have to tell you, they don't work like your textbook says. They don't work like the Constitution says or your social studies book. It doesn't work like, oh, a majority of members of Congress want something and therefore it becomes a law. That's not how it works, folks. And so this is really your chance to ask me questions, to find out what you think. Again, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can, if you just like the numbers, it's 877-577-2667. Or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. I want to start, though, by talking about gas prices because, well, you notice them. That's the first thing you notice. And I'm the first to tell you I'm not happy about paying more than $30 to fill up my gas tank. So it's certainly not something I enjoy. But maybe we need some tough medicine. You know, way back in Jimmy Carter's day, he was trying to move our energy sources over. You know, back during the first oil crisis, the first oil crisis was actually back in 74. It was during the Ford administration, actually, and part of it during Nixon administration. The Arabs had invaded Israel. It was on Yom Kippur, the holiest Jewish day. And the United States was helping Israel survive and not be wiped off the face of the earth. And so at that time, the Arabs responded with the first OPEC oil shock, the first time that they cut gasoline production to raise prices. And there were lines around the corners. And then the second oil shock was in the Carter regime, the Carter presidency in the late 70s. And that hurt our economy pretty badly. In fact, a lot of the high unemployment and high inflation in the Carter years was caused by high oil prices. So clearly, it definitely hurts our economy. And yet, what happened in the early 80s? Do you remember? We went from these big gas-guzzling cars to some of these smaller cars. At that time, frankly, Japanese cars, European cars were doing better than American cars because instead of these big boats that everybody was driving, suddenly people were looking at Toyotas. People were looking at Saabs and BMWs and cars that achieved better gas mileage because the price had gone up. Well, move on to the late 80s and the first Bush administration, the first administration of Texas oilmen. And then what happens? Well, gas prices go down. And when gas prices go down, suddenly everybody starts to like SUVs. I mean, you know there's a tax benefit for SUVs. Did you know that? I mean, a lot of people don't even know that. If you buy an SUV, the biggest, worst gas-guzzling vehicle around, okay, you get a tax cut. You get a tax benefit. In fact, if it's not large enough, you don't get the benefit. It's got to be larger and more inefficient. You get your tax benefit. And I don't think I need to tell you folks in the audience that the SUV is the most dangerous car on the road today. It's not just, you know, people who drive SUVs, they think it's just dangerous to people around them. They think, well, if I get hit with a small car, I'll crush them, but I'll be fine, which is obviously a very selfish thought. But it also is more dangerous to the people in SUVs. You see, it has a high center of gravity, and therefore it's more likely to roll over. It is 2.5 more times, you are 2.5 more times likely to die in your SUV than you would in your regular car. Now, you know, all right, Mark Levine doesn't like SUVs. I'm just railing on them. And there's some truth to that. I don't like SUVs. I drive a great car that's low-centered. It drives really well, and I hate it when I can't see around the SUV into traffic. I don't know whether he's going really slow because there's a long line ahead of him, or maybe he's going 10 miles an hour because it's some, you know, very slow driver. Maybe an elderly driver in front of me, and I can go around them, but I can't see around the SUV. Okay, all right, I hate that. But it's more than that. The SUV is a gas guzzler. And if there's any reason, and it's hard to imagine a reason, if there's any reason why we're in Iraq, why we care so much about Kuwait, why we didn't care about, you know, Rwanda, and we don't care about Sudan, but we care about Kuwait and Iraq and Saudi Arabia, and we help these dictators, why? Oil. It's all about oil. It's all about having a regular source of oil coming at us. And if we didn't have to rely so much on foreign oil, I don't think we'd be going off and doing these stupid wars, wasting hundreds of billions of dollars, not to mention hundreds of American lives, thousands injured. We all know they went to war for oil. I mean, if anyone doubts that, just read the book on by Ron Suskind, The Price of Loyalty, that talks about Paul O'Neill, where he goes in the first week of the Bush administration and shows how they divided up Iraq into various oil fields. We all know they went to war for oil, but if we had an oil tax, then maybe less people would use it. You know, I'm an economics major. I believe in economics. I'm not a socialist. I believe in some manner of socialism. I don't believe in pure capitalism either. But when you raise prices, people use gas less. And now, I'm not saying, I know this will hurt people, I know this will hurt poor families, and so I want to make it revenue neutral. I want to raise gas taxes, but at the same time, give people back that money in another way, okay? You can just give, you know, if you want, $3,000 to every American, or figure out what the price is. Let's make it revenue neutral. Let's make sure that people aren't really hurting out there. That's fine. But, and I know that most people don't support this. Hey, you know, Bush keeps attacking Kerry for this idea 10 years ago that Kerry proposed and never had a chance to vote on. But how about, shouldn't we raise gas taxes? Let me hear from you on that, or really anything else you want to talk about. It's sort of a potpourri today, since my guest didn't show. 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your first name and where are you from?
Hey, Mark. This is Brian from New Jersey.
Hey, Brian from New Jersey. You want to comment on gasoline prices or anything else about my show?
Well, I just want to say that I wouldn't listen or call in if I didn't like all the shows. So they're all pretty good.
Thank you. That's always good to hear. You know, I like the compliments. Keep them coming.
It's actually very hard to understand what you're saying right now for some reason, though.
Oh, is it?
I can really barely understand what you're saying.
I apologize. Is it better now?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay, all right.
I would like to comment a little bit on the gasoline issue.
Sure.
I totally agree with increasing gasoline tax. I think that we take it for granted that we can just drive anywhere we want to go. If you look at any of the other major countries, they have wonderful, wonderful systems of public transportation that we really don't have here, which is partly our government's fault. But, I mean, I live in a very suburban area. I have a shopping center maybe a half a mile away from my house. The bank is a half a mile away. I'll walk there. I don't know how many people in my neighborhood wouldn't walk there. They'd take their car, but they could walk there. It's not that big of a deal.
You know, I'm shocked that in the New York metropolitan area, and I was just in New York, that LaGuardia Airport isn't reachable by the subway. The subway goes everywhere, but it doesn't go to LaGuardia, it doesn't go to Kennedy. I don't know of a single European nation, maybe someone can tell me one, where they have the largest city, London, Paris, Berlin, Rome, you name it, you know, the subway goes to the airport. I don't know what our problem is.
It's
a totally waste of gasoline. And what it is that people have, you know, the taxi drivers, they make money, you know, sure, by sending. People don't ever want to change anything. And I think that if we raise gas prices, that's just a nice way across the board. You know, people have to find savings somewhere. Maybe they won't buy SUVs. Maybe, it may increase airline tickets, and then people will take the train more. The point is I want to provide the money back. I don't want to increase – I mean, I know it hurts people, so I want to give them, you know, a credit back. But at the same time, the most important thing to me is we wouldn't be relying so much on foreign oil, which is, I think, the reason for all our horrible foreign policy.
Right. I mean, and a problem with raising the gas tax is not only are you going to raise – how much it costs to transport you, but you're raising the cost of how much it transports food, which is going to increase the food production. It's going to increase the cost of basically everything that you buy.
That's true.
There's no reason that we shouldn't just go to alternative energy, since we know that we have the technology and it's these huge corporations that are holding us back. If they have the technology, we should be out there protesting at their gates. Let it out, because it's time. And then that's my argument.
Well, that's a good point, Brian. Let me be clear. I definitely support alternative technologies. Like I said, Jimmy Carter is the last president that I'm aware of to really go in and support alternative energy sources to help solar energy and so forth. I think that if you increase the prices on oil, eventually people are going to have to – that's the way the capitalist system works. People are going to eventually turn to these alternative fuel sources. You know, in Europe, they pay much more than we do for gas. They pay much more than they do in Canada as well. We can take that money that we get from the gasoline tax and just turn it around, give it as a tax credit to people. I'm not trying to make money here, but just sort of change the way people think, and maybe we will develop fuel cells. You know, California developed a hydrogen fuel cell car, basically a car that runs on water. And no state followed because it was a little more expensive. I guarantee you, if gas prices, if it's $40, $50 to fill up a tank, more people are going to look at buying hydrogen fuel cell cars. And maybe we need to do tax credits for them and not for SUVs. I know my position isn't popular. I'll tell you, I don't even think John Kerry would take my position. He's being attacked for doing it. I don't know any politician can take this position. And yet, wouldn't it help us in the long run? I think so. Hey, Brian, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your first name? Where are you from?
This is Bert from Minnesota.
Hey, Bert from Minnesota. What do you think about my radical idea that no politician will support to raise gas taxes?
Oh, well, I was listening to that, and boy, I really think there's a lot of parallels. I'm kind of a scientist. I think there's a lot of parallels in what you're describing right there and parasites, the study of the biology of parasites. I think you ought to have, as one of your guests sometime, a biologist who's got special training in parasitology.
Okay.
And see if he can find any parallels between, you know, how we've become oil dependent and how our laws bring more oil dependence. And there's a lot of good stuff there.
Okay, Mr. Biologist, explain to me, because I'm missing your metaphor here. Who are the parasites?
Well, it's the parasite, anytime... Gosh, I actually wanted to talk about something else.
Okay, well, no, you can talk about something else. I was just unclear. Are you saying that the oil companies are parasites, or who's living off whom? I just want to understand what you're saying.
Classically, a parasite is any organism that doesn't help the good of.
No,
it lives off of the other.
Right, I understand that.
Of the host.
Well, I'm just trying to understand your metaphor. Who is the parasite in your metaphor? I mean, who is it? America? Are we a parasite on others? Are others parasites on us?
Well, it depends on how you want to look at it. But in this case, it would be the need for oil, and let's just give it a name. Let's say the Saudis.
Uh-huh.
The Saudis have this. It's a bond between America that they're basically taking our resources and, you know, money, and we're fighting wars, and, you know, we have laws and stuff like that. And I think there's probably some parallels there you could develop.
Okay, so they're living off us basically because they have power over us by this one thing, oil. I mean, we wouldn't give a damn about Saudi Arabia, you know, this large desert, if it weren't for oil. I totally agree with you on that. But you wanted to raise something else. And I said, it's not just about oil today, folks. It's anything you want to raise about my show. Feel free, bring it on. Bert, so what's your point? Your other point.
Okay, and I should say also that I can hardly hear you. It's very garbled. I wanted to take it back to 9/11, and because a lot of the whole gas thing comes back to adaptation, and you know, the basically we've said that we're big, we can kind of push nations around, we don't care. I mean, the Bush foreign policy has been basically bullying everyone, everything. And I had three paragraphs here from an author named Carl Sagan.
Sure.
The situation is that the Voyager spacecraft is on its way out to Pluto. It's never going to be heard from again. It's at the last, you know, it's headed out of the solar system. They commanded this craft to turn around and take a picture of the Earth, and we're looking at a picture that's been digitally enhanced to the maximum of the technology, and there's a little blue speck in the middle of the picture.
Okay, and that's all we are, a little blue speck. Now, your point is?
We succeeded in taking that picture from deep space, and if you look at it, you see a dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you've ever heard of, every human being who ever lived out of their lives, lived out their lives. The aggregate of all our joys and sufferings, thousands of confident religions, and it goes on and on, and basically says, we're just a speck here. We need to work together. Whatever we do is going to come back and touch us. We really need to start thinking globally here.
Well, I think that's certainly we do. You know, it's one thing. You know, the United States, we're always thinking about ourselves only, and obviously we need to think about everybody, because it all comes back to haunt us. You know, it's like karma, right? You could do a good deed and it comes back and it helps you. You do a bad one, and I mean, the whole world loved us 3 years ago. Not the whole world, okay, fine. Al-Qaeda hated us, no question about it. But when Al-Qaeda attacked us, it wasn't just European countries. Latin American countries, African countries, even Arab countries, even Arabs, most of them, understood that that was an unfair, an awful, horrible thing that Al-Qaeda did, and we had the whole world supporting us and going in there and attacking Afghanistan. And you're right, what we do on Earth matters. I mean, look at what we've done in Iraq. We've turned the entire world against us. I don't know if that's the point you're trying to make, but anything further you want to say, Bert? We got to go to a break.
Okay.
Thanks very much for your call. I appreciate that. We're going to go to a break. I'm going to read some of the comments I'm getting on emails. Again, you can send a comment to comment@radioinsidescoop.com, or you can call in 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. What do you think of my radical proposal to increase gasoline taxes? What do you think in general of the Inside Scoop? Is there a show that you want to see that you haven't seen? Is there a point of contention you have with something I've said? You disagree with me? You agree with me? You want to ask me a question about how things go on in Congress? Here's your chance. Call in 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be back right after these messages.
Chipped yet? A company called Applied Digital Solutions wants you to undergo a surgical procedure to implant a tiny RFID microchip in your arm. Why would you want to do this? Because radio frequency ID chips will eliminate the heavy burden of having to carry credit cards and remember your ATM numbers. Instead, your arm becomes your card and ID number. Simply run your arm under a scanner, and your embedded radio chip sends a digital signal to the computer, allowing you to complete your transaction. ADS calls its microchip VeriPay. There's only one rational reason that ADS executives think we'll submit to this. They're insane. Insane, but serious. They insist that this technological leap is needed because many people lose their credit cards. VeriPay solves that problem, says a corporate PR flack, cheerfully noting that ADS's chip is subdermal and very difficult to lose. You don't leave it sitting in the back seat of a taxi, he said. Subdermal or not, your ID number still can be stolen by a geeky thief who rigs up a device to intercept your radio-transmitted number, then plays it back later to your ATM machine, emptying your account. If your number is stolen, or if you simply switch credit card companies or banks, what are you to do? No problem, says the PR guy. If you don't want it anymore, you can go to a doctor and have it removed. I call it an opt-out feature, he said gaily. Swell. Instead of simply calling your credit card company to cancel your card, you'd have to call a surgeon. This is progress. Still, ADS is banking on you to get chipped, as they cheerily put it, even offering a $50 discount to the first 100,000 people who sign up. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, the honchos of ADS are such business geniuses that the company's stock plummeted from $12 a share 3 years ago to about 40 cents today. I wouldn't entrust two bits to them, much less my arm.
It's difficult enough to work your way through this jungle called life every day without having to carry an 800-pound gorilla of high-interest student loans around with you. So just do what over 300,000 people have already done and call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. College Loan Corporation will gladly give you the advice you need while helping you look into interest rates as low as 2.63%, the lowest federal rates in 40 years. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. And today we're talking about gas prices. Well, among other things, you can talk about anything you want to talk about here today. But one of the things about gas prices is that they are at their highest levels that we've seen ever. They're over $2 a gallon. But even if you look at it adjusted for inflation, they're quite high. They're the second highest, in fact, in American history. So why is it that I still propose actually raising the gas tax? That may seem like a crazy idea. I can tell you that it's something that both Bush and Kerry are against. Now, Bush has been claiming that Kerry supported a gas tax hike 10 years ago. Kerry never voted on that and hasn't supported it since. And in fact, one of the things that they've discussed is reducing the amount of gas that's going into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Now, that's a reserve that's millions of gallons of gasoline. And the whole purpose of that reserve is precisely, well, we can argue about the purpose, but as far as I'm concerned, the purpose is to deal with high gasoline prices. Others say it's, of course, if we have a crisis, we need the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The question is not whether to actually empty the reserve. Although I should note that Bill Clinton emptied that reserve during his presidency, actually decreased gas prices when it had a little spike and kept those gas prices pretty even at $35 a gallon. But Kerry says that we should stop emptying into the reserve, which makes a lot of sense because why are we purchasing this oil from Saudi Arabia at these enormous prices? We know prices are going to go down because Saudi Arabia has said they're going to increase oil in time for Bush's election, of course, and lower prices. So why are we paying high prices now for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve when we can pay less prices later on? Again, Kerry's idea is stop filling the reserve, and Bush's idea is to keep filling it, keep paying those high prices to those Texas oil companies and to the Saudis. Let me say that I don't think it's inconsistent to support higher taxes and at the same time do things like increasing the reserve so as to lower oil prices. You see, if we stop filling the reserve, okay, we stop giving huge amounts of money to people who really are our enemies. Remember, every dollar that goes to Saudi Arabia, a portion of that dollar is used to train Islamic terrorists. It's used to go to madrasas, these radical Islamic schools across the world, teaching people how to hate us. That's where our money's going. So I say, actually let some oil out of the reserve, decrease the money we pay to Saudi Arabia, and if you put a nice tax in there, what that does is it makes more people pay more so they conserve energy. We're going to refund the money to them, the gas money to them, so people aren't really hurting, because I know this is, you know, I'd even write checks if we had to people so that they're not hurting, because I know that this is painful on our economy. But at the same time, we're not giving the money to these lunatics that turn around and then try to kill so many Americans. It's a radical idea. I don't expect any party to support it, but it's mine, and I want to know what you think. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your first name? Where are you from?
Yeah, this is Gordon from Michigan.
Hey, Gordon from Michigan. How are you?
I'm all righty.
You want to talk about gas prices or anything else? Anything's open today.
Well, I guess if I can talk about anything, I'd like to, wow, are you getting that static?
Yeah, and it's very weird to me. I don't know why it's coming from. Is it very strong in your ears? Try again. Gordon?
Okay,
is it better now?
I'd like to talk about, this Dennis Kucinich bill.
Okay.
About the Department of Peace. It's currently got about, 50 supporters, and I'm wondering, if you were a lobbyist, what kind of strategy would you employ to try to push this thing through? Not necessarily, this term or the next term, or, you know, it might take a matter of many years, but what kind of strategies would you employ and try to push this thing through?
Well, I think that the strategies you employ for any bill are pretty much the same. First, you get a original co-sponsor, which you've gotten. You've got Kucinich. You get a member of Congress. If you have any idea at all, this, by the way, works no matter what your views are. You go to a member of Congress, you get their backing, and obviously you have that in Dennis Kucinich. The next step is to get more co-sponsors and to get more members of Congress to sign on to the bill. Now, there's several ways this is done. One is Dennis Kucinich can send out what's called a Dear Colleague letter. And basically that's a letter from one member of Congress to other members of Congress, and it goes out and it says, hey, this is a great bill. I like it for this reason. It's good for these reasons. You should support it as well. The other thing to do is grassroots, is you get people all across the country. You send out emails. You let people know. You're in Michigan. You call your representative. And you let them know what you think and get them to sign on. And you get sort of a critical mass, you know, get more than 100 or even more than 200 co-sponsors. Now, at the end of the day, you can get 400 co-sponsors and there are 435 members in the House of Representatives. That doesn't make a bill pass. That's not how it works. That may be how the Constitution says it works. That's not how it works. The way it works is the majority party, at least in the House of Representatives, the majority party controls something called the Rules Committee, and that means that they get to decide every single bill that gets voted on. So if Tom DeLay doesn't want to vote on the Department of Peace, there will be no vote on the Department of Peace, even if you got 400 members that are supporting it. Now, if you got 400 members that are supporting it, there's a lot of pressure on him to back off. But at the end of the day, the majority party rules. So if you think that it's a bill that only Democrats will support, and again, Gordon, I'm not just talking about the Department of Peace. I'm talking about really any bill that anyone out there wants to get through Congress. You've got to have really your party behind it. That's why a lot of people who want to vote for Greens and vote for Ralph Nader and so forth really, really are throwing away their vote in our two-party system. That doesn't mean I necessarily support two-party system. I'm just explaining how it works. And the way it works is you've got to get your party to support it. Now, if we had a Democratic majority in Congress, they would control the Rules Committee. They would control what bills go to the floor, what gets voted on. Now, it's a little different in the Senate. In the Senate, the minority party has a bit more power. The Democrats are a minority in the Senate, and they can filibuster Republican bills. All they need is 41 votes to do that. And because of that, 41 out of 100, they have more power. They can actually come in and actually force the Republicans to make deals. Also in the Senate, they can amend bills. You can have a bill on one topic, and they can throw in another topic and throw it all in one big mess, which is one way of getting an issue through the Senate, at least, that wouldn't otherwise be gotten through. But you can't do that in the House. The Rules Committee is very strong, and that's why, really, the majority very strongly rules in the House. And, you know, I know people that want to vote for, say, moderate Republicans, and they're decent moderate Republicans out there. Chris Shays of Connecticut comes to mind. But every time you vote for a Republican, they kill a puppy. No, I mean, every time you vote for a Republican, in essence, they do, because even if your Republican is moderate, even if they're moderate, then they vote for Tom DeLay to run the House, and he does, and then Tom DeLay gets to decide what happens. So until we get a majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives, it's very hard to get any of our agenda through. Now, we can stop bad stuff. We can still work to stop bad stuff. And largely what I did in Congress since I was in the minority was work to help stop bad stuff or amend bad stuff so it wasn't so bad. But if you have a positive agenda, like your Department of Peace, Gordon, you're going to need a Democratic Congress. You're going to have to elect a majority of Democrats.
As a lobbyist, can't you flavor the bill into a bipartisan type of track of this?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there was a time before George W. Bush when both parties, Republicans and Democrats, reached out to the other side, tried to get bipartisan bills passed, really tried to get bills that everyone could support. Indeed, in fact, the very first time we did the Patriot Act, we actually worked hard on it and put it through the House Judiciary Committee and actually came up with a bill. Most people don't even know this. When I was sitting on the committee at the time, we had everyone on the committee from, you know, left liberal Maxine Waters to right winger Bob Barr, Lamar Smith, Barney Frank, Sheila Jackson Lee, John Conyers, you know, very far left, far right. They all came together to agree on a bipartisan compromise, which was amazing. It was shocking. It was really post-September 11th. Everyone thought they'd put their partisanship aside and come together with a balanced bill that would still let us spy on terrorists but not let us spy on ordinary American citizens. And that bill passed unanimously, came to the House floor. John Ashcroft ripped it up, put in a new bill, gave everyone an hour to read it, and that's the bill that became the Patriot Act. This administration has no interest in doing anything on a bipartisan basis. That's why bill after bill after bill is squeaked through by one vote or two votes, or they're losing and then they have to twist votes on the floor. The Bush administration has made it clear they are dividers, not uniters. They don't give a damn about bipartisanship. They don't want to be bipartisan. And so really there's almost no bipartisanship in Congress anywhere today.
That's what we can look forward to, Kerry, and hopefully some more Democrats in the House and the Senate to change that whole tint and taint on our system.
Well, I think that would be critical. I really do. Bill Clinton, and I got to tell you, some liberals didn't like Bill Clinton for this reason, but Bill Clinton definitely was a bipartisan kind of guy. He looked for proposals that could get support from both Democrats and Republicans. His welfare reform bill, which was harshly criticized by a lot of liberals, and we can argue over whether it was right or not, but one thing's for sure, it was a bipartisan bill, and I think it's largely because of Clinton's bipartisan treatment that he led us to the greatest surpluses in American history. And you can argue that he should have spent the money on this, that, or the other, but I think that a centrist like Clinton, it's why he got so overwhelmingly reelected in 96. And someone who plays to their base like Bush, he's going to have a tough time, I think. I hope.
Hey, I really think bipartisanship is the spirit of America, and it should be kept alive.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's – look, obviously when you're elected, you should help your supporters. I'd be unhappy with Kerry if he went right down the middle. He's left of center, and he should rule, you know, left of center. But the point is that you can rule and take a bill and propose something in a way that really includes the best ideas of the other side. And
right.
I think that, you know, just about any idea you have, someone from another party can make it a little better. You know, maybe they're not going to change more than 5% of it, but they can always do it. I mean, I'll just give an example. I wrote 5 of the 200 pages of the Patriot Act. Now, I don't like the Patriot Act. I think most of it's pretty bad. What's that? No, I didn't write most of it. I wrote five pages. It's a 200-page bill. It's a 200-page bill. I wrote 5 pages of it, and I'd be willing to grant you that most of it's pretty bad. A little of it's good. My 5 pages, what it did is it said if the Patriot Act is misused, you can sue the government. That's all my five pages do. It's a relief. It says that if they spy on you and they find information on you and you haven't committed a crime, you haven't committed a terrorist act, you haven't committed an immigration violation, then you can sue the government and get damages. Now, I wanted a lot of damages and I wanted attorney's fees, and the Republicans whittled that down to virtually nothing. But at least the principle is there that you can get a court to rule that they shouldn't have violated your rights. Now, what did I do? I took a horrible bill and I made it slightly better. So it's still bad. And my boss, Barney Frank, still voted against it, but we were able to improve it ever so slightly. And sometimes I think people who are purists say, well, you know, hey, I'm not going to intervene in such a thing. You can improve a bill and still vote against it. That's what Barney Frank did. I agree with you. I think that we need more bipartisanship. And if you have an idea, whether it's the Department of Peace or anything else, frankly, if you could find a Republican co-sponsor, and I don't know if you could or not, that would definitely help your bill.
I've got a Republican representative, so I'm...
Well, go to him.
I'm drilling her right now.
Her, but, okay. Go to her.
I think I've been too negative with her so far. I'm going to have to ease up a little bit and try to...
try.
Compassionate.
Try both. See if she'll sign on. And if not, you know, work to defeat her in the fall. That's what American democracy is all about.
Well, yeah, the catchphrase is nobody's got a monopoly on the truth, and...
I firmly believe that. In fact, the only absolute truth I know of is that no one has the absolute truth. Hey, Gordon, thanks very much for your call. I appreciate every time you call. All right, we're going to go to a break right now. When we come back, you can call, talk about anything you like, or you can talk about my radical proposal to increase gas taxes. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667, or you can send an email to comment at radioinsidescoop.com. I've got a bunch of emails, and I'll be reading them right after the break. Again, number's 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be back right after this.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
15 Chinese men who were captured during World War II and forced to work as slaves in Japanese coal mines will not receive reparations for their ordeal, according to a decision handed down in a Japanese high court this week. In 2002, another court ruled the government and Mitsui Mining Company owed the men compensation for being slaves and awarded them a $1.4 million judgment, but it was overturned on appeal due to the fact that the men waited more than 20 years to bring the lawsuit. In all, some 39,000 Chinese slaves were brought to Japan during World War II, and similar lawsuits are still working their way through the Japanese legal system.
After a 100,000-strong four-day walkout, the Communication Workers of America have reached a tentative agreement with SBC Communications on a new five-year contract. An annual 2.3% wage increase with an additional 1% payment in the first year is part of the settlement, which also includes a five-year ban on some layoffs and potentially moving offshore jobs back to the United States after 2007. However, it does not guarantee job security for new employees and allows SBC to require employees to pay for health insurance for some family members.
Tyson Foods goes after migrant workers again, this time in Canada. At a meatpacking plant in Brooks, Alberta, several dozen workers, mostly from Sudan, tried to establish a dialogue with Tyson managers about their working conditions. Simple things like bathroom breaks and access to company nurses for injuries suffered on the job. Last month, just after the workers organized a committee to approach Tyson management, the entire committee was fired, along with several dozen others. Neither federal nor provincial officials seem willing to investigate the firings.
A unique conscience clause in their union contract is allowing postal workers in Wales to refuse to deliver a mailing put out by the right-wing British National Party. The refusal by 2,000 communication workers union members to deliver the anti-immigrant election leaflet is the first time CWU members have invoked their conscience clause. Postal workers say they work in ethnic neighborhoods and will not deliver what they call hateful and inflammatory literature, linking asylum seekers with suicide bombers.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Teenagers looking for a summer job are finding slimmer pickings and more competition this year. The Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University reports 37% of American teens held jobs last year. That's a decrease of nearly 10% since 2000 and the lowest recorded since the center began tracking it in 1948. cuts in state summer job programs and increased competition for jobs from a swollen pool of unemployed adults lies at the root of the problem.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about gas prices and really anything you want to talk about. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. And I've gotten a lot of comments, and I'm finding surprising agreement. I thought that I was going to take a really controversial topic here. That's something that neither Republicans nor Democrats are willing to support. And you listeners, you agree with me, which is very interesting. I've got an email here from Mark. Doesn't say where he's from. I don't read last names on the air. But Mark writes, would increased gas prices and taxes also make the local economy flourish? Increased gas prices would make products shipped from other areas more costly, making people more likely to buy products made locally in their hometown or state, especially foods. It would also make people think more about carpooling and allowing more funding for public transportation. I want to see $5 a gallon. I hate cars and people who just hop in them to travel a block away and complain about not being able to find a place to park. How about $10 a gallon? I'm all for it. We can take some of the money from gas taxes to fund public transportation and health care costs, from health problems, from all the pollution cars put into our environment. Thank you for that, Mark. I appreciate that. Got another email here from Vince. Vince writes, Mark, kind of ironic about your idea of increasing gas taxes. Here in upstate New York, we have some of the highest taxes in the country, including gasoline. Currently, some of the Republican officials here are proposing to forgo the fuel taxes during the summer months to ease the impact during our high travel months. Meanwhile, all sorts of programs, school budgets, etc., are being cut due to lack of funds. Can you say pay me now or pay me later? Regards, Vince from Rochester, New York. Vince, that's exactly right. You know, people think that when you do a tax, they think immediately of paying the tax. They don't think about the benefits of the tax money. You can refund the tax money. You can make it revenue neutral. You can put it into our schools. You can just put it as a check back to people so they get the money back. I have no problem with that. But what it does do is it starts to get us thinking about alternatives. You know what? If you have an SUV, fine. You want to have your SUV, fine. You have to understand that you are causing us all kinds of problems in America. You are causing us to be more reliant on Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabian oil. You're causing more pollution in the air. You're also causing more danger on the roads. So if you want to have an SUV, you know what? You should pay extra for it. You shouldn't get a tax cut. You want it? Fine, I understand you got to carry your children. I don't know what happened to old station wagons. When I grew up, we had station wagons. They weren't beautiful cars. True, I admit that. But they carried a lot of people places, and they didn't use all the gasoline, the huge amounts of gasoline that SUVs use. And what about Hummers? I mean, we got all kinds of devices that use... I mean, okay, you're in a war. I understand you need a Humvee. I respect that. But what do you need a Humvee if you're not in a war? And how many extra people are you going to carry with that? It seems to me that that's just a completely wasteful thing. If you want it, maybe we should just have a luxury tax. Again, what do you think? 877-57-SCOOP. Lines are open. Or send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Got another comment here from Ryan. Let's see where Ryan's from. Doesn't say. But he writes, I agree with you about raising the cost of gas. Ryan writes, Mark, I really enjoy your show. Keep up the good work. I wanted to agree with you on your position about raising gas prices. If gas prices increase, it would force Americans to look at conserving gas in the form of choosing more fuel-efficient vehicles, using public transportation or carpooling. People might be unhappy in the short term, but the long-term benefits would be a healthier environment with cleaner air and a reduction of oil consumption as a nation. Additionally, it would also force Americans to reduce sprawl, revitalize urban centers, as people would want to live closer to where they work. I also wanted to make the comment, and I did, by the way, open it up to any comments, not just on the gas tax, at 877-57-SCOOP. Ryan says, I also wanted to make the comment that I find it troubling that we only focus on the 800 American soldiers that have died in this war. There are thousands more American soldiers that have been injured, and beyond that, we have killed thousands of Iraqi citizens. I don't know the exact number. I think that we need to humanize these Iraqi citizens and think of them as human beings and not some abstract enemy. They are just like you and me, with families who have suffered under Saddam and now continue to suffer under the U.S. occupation. The loss of another human life to ensure a steady supply of oil to the U.S. Makes clear that we need to reduce our consumption and look into alternative renewable energy sources. Keep up the good work, Ryan. You know, Ryan, I think you make a good point about the soldiers. And I think you noticed that I said, I didn't just mention the 800 Americans. I did mention the thousands that have been wounded. Indeed, some 6,000 Americans have been seriously wounded, having lost limbs. They have to start over again, and they really are undergoing a lot of hardship. But you also make the point, and I think it's a good one, and I didn't mention them, and I apologize for that, to talk about the Iraqi citizens. You know, I think that sometimes Americans look at war like a video game. You know, you shoot at the enemy, and then beep, they disappear, right? They just go off the screen. And sometimes when the Pentagon brings back pictures, they bring back pictures like that. They never show the actual soldiers, you know, they never show bunches of dead bodies. It's just boop, and the person disappears, just as if it were a video game. And it's not like that. In fact, there are thousands of Iraqi citizens dead, and indeed most estimates say more than 10,000. And what's interesting is that they've compared the number of Iraqis that Saddam Hussein killed and the number of Iraqis that the U.S. occupation force killed, and there's not that big a difference between them. It's maybe 15,000 for Saddam a year and 10,000 for us. Now, I'm not saying all of them are innocent. I realize some of them attacked our troops. Some of them supported Saddam, but I would think a lot of them are. And a lot of them are just doing what I think comes naturally, what Americans would do if we had, you know, someone come into our nation and tell us how to run things, even if we lived under dictatorship. I mean, even when England ran what was going on in America, you know, if another country came in, we might say, we don't want to live under England, but we don't want to live under you either. And so people are just defending their place, and I think we should look at the Iraqi citizens, absolutely. I think that's one reason why the tortures at Abu Ghraib prison really hit home to Americans in a way that not much did before then. I think people started to realize, hey, you know, these are people, and we can't mistreat them. And this idea of, oh, everyone we're fighting against is really our enemy, is really awful, awful people. Now we have the Red Cross report, and it says the 70 to 90% of the people in Iraqi jails are innocent. So, you know, Ryan, I think you're right. I mean, when we know that, and we've tortured all these innocent people, now I think Americans are seeing, you know what, if we don't have really strong rules and regulations, we become like what we hate. We abuse. We torture. And I think that what's coming out more and more now, and we're seeing more and more, of course, is as it goes to the very top, that Don Rumsfeld and General Sanchez and General Miller all made sure that we brought in these interrogation tactics. That was no accident. There was no accident that Lindy England, let's say vertically challenged, a fairly small woman from West Virginia who was in the reserves, who had only run a pizza place, you know, I don't, and nothing against people who run pizza places. I like pizza. I respect pizza. But I don't think it was Lindy England's idea to strip people naked and put electrodes on their genitalia and to, you know, point at them and laugh. I just don't think that was her idea. You know, I don't know. But I think it goes to the very top. Let me read some more comments that I have here on gas prices. This is Kyle from Alberta, Canada. Hey, I like having Canadian listeners. I've heard now from England, France, the Netherlands, Taiwan. Thank you, Kyle, from Canada, Alberta. Terrific to have a new listener from Alberta. Mark, I think you're one of the most intelligent voices on the radio internet, and I wish there were more of you out there. You know, Kyle, now I really like you. Boy, you write, the alternative fuel source debate is a double-edged sword. First, unfortunately, hydrogen needs enormous quantities of energy to produce it. That is, coal or natural gas power plants. Second, we will never get rid of the need for oil as long as there is a Texas oil baron and the president of Halliburton in the White House. One of the best parts about using less oil is that we wouldn't be funding our enemy, the terrorists, anymore. Well, Kyle, I couldn't agree with you more, and not just because you complimented me so much, but I want to thank you very much for listening in and for your comments. Obviously, you're absolutely right. To the extent that hydrogen needs quantities of energy to produce it, look, I think any alternative fuel source at the beginning takes tremendous effort. I know that's why it's more expensive. That's why we have the expensive alternative energy fuel sources. That's why California had to give a subsidy, and I really wish the other states had fallen suit. By increasing the price of oil, which after all is not a renewable resource. We're going to have to get at some point to an alternative fuel source. At some point, oil is going to dry up anyway. By increasing the price of oil now, we help protect us for later. We help increasing the incentives to develop alternative fuel sources now so that we have them when we need them, 30 years, 50 years, when the oil supply runs out, and more particularly so that we're not helping our enemies. I'm tired of helping our enemies. Where did Osama bin Laden get his money? Saudi Arabia. Where did Saudi Arabia get their money? Texas oil companies. Where did they get their money? You and me. We filled up our SUVs, and we funded the people who killed 3,000 Americans. And maybe we need to start saying if you have an SUV, you're not patriotic. Look, I don't want to go that far. People have to carry children in their SUVs. I understand that. But, hey, look, at least they could pay more prices, higher prices. I want to get to Ben, though. Ben is my faithful conservative listener who can always be trusted to disagree with me. He disagrees with me on gas, and he disagrees with me on something else, which I'll get to in a minute. But on gas, Ben writes, I have an SUV. I didn't get a tax break. Why don't you tell the stipulations? Or do you not know which SUVs apply? In fact, it's not SUVs at all. It's vehicles over a certain weight used for business purposes. There you go again, proving your points with half the story. I love it. Well, I did bring up, Ben, that it had to be over a certain weight. Indeed, I think that that is particularly stupid. I think that, you know, think about it. The more gas guzzling it is, the more likely it is to cause an accident, the more likely it is to kill somebody because it's overweight, the more likely you are to get the tax break. I should have mentioned it's only for business purposes. Fine. But the point is that the idea that you get a tax break, the more you have a car that pollutes, the more you have a car that gas guzzles, the more you have a car that kills people, and the more you have a car that's heavier and has a higher center of gravity and rolls over, that is ridiculous. And I just wanted to point that out. Ben, your other comment I want to get to, because you raised it yesterday. I didn't get a chance to deal with it yesterday. You asked me, how can you bash Bush for not listening to his general on troop numbers and then bash him for saying he's going to ask his general if there is a need for more troops? Sounds like a double standard. Let me explain what Ben's talking about. Ben is right that I said that Bush should have listened to Eric Shinseki. Now, Eric Shinseki is the general who said it was going to take at least 200,000 troops to conquer Iraq. He said it before the Iraq War. If Bush had listened to Shinseki, maybe we wouldn't go to war with Iraq at all. Maybe, you know, we would have kept the troops in Afghanistan fighting al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, who all signs are is preparing to attack us again. We could actually protect American security, actually protect us against terrorism instead of going to war in Iraq. Now I picked on him, Ben's right, because he says, well, whatever General Abizid writes, I'll give him. First of all, it's a flip-flop. Okay, now, you know, flip-flops aren't necessarily bad. I would appreciate, for example, if Bush realizes his mistakes, turn around and learns how to, you know, fight a war in Iraq the right way. I would appreciate if he'd flip-flop on that. So flip-flops aren't necessarily bad. But the point is this. He went to war without listening to his generals. He got himself up to, you know, he's got stuff up to his neck in Iraq. He's totally floundering. And now he listens to his generals? You know, now, look. Okay, fair enough, Ben. I'm glad he's listening to his generals now. I do think he should have done it a year ago. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. You got 1 minute. Go. What's your first name? Where are you from?
Ed, Mark, from Montana, and I'd like to thank you for all your interesting and informative information on how our system works in Washington. It's very enlightening to know. I'd like to say I have a little problem with your increase in price of gas.
Okay.
There's so many people that are so dependent on their cars. They're really not driving for pleasure, especially out here in the West, where it's just a matter of making a living, guys going to work, and it's the burden on them would be just like having a big national sales tax.
Okay.
Well,
Ed,
fall on the people at the bottom of the ladder are least able to afford it.
Ed, I hear you. How about if we were to do this? If we raised the gas tax, but we were to give you a nice check that covered your costs. How about that? Then it shouldn't matter, should it?
Oh, yeah. I see what you're saying, and that would be nice if you could do it. I mean, I think it's something that's got to be approached gradually, maybe some sort of a cap right now on the amount, and then as the prices go down, we could use some of that revenue. And it's a good idea, but I just
I hear you, Ed.
See the government just come straight out with the the encouragement that you spoke about, you know, working for solar, wind, other alternative fuels, put the money just like Carter did, and also the example that Carter set, he kept the temperature down in the White House.
Right.
And of course, the irony was that as soon as Reagan came in, he ripped the solar panels off of the White House.
You're a great caller.
Really, set us back.
Unfortunately, I'm running out of time. I hope you'll call back on another show. It's just getting too close to the hour here.
Okay, but thank you, Mark.
Please call back another time. I'll tell you, Ed's a first-time caller. I hope he'll call back. But, you know, we got to end the show at a certain time, and that's just the way it goes on the Inside Scoop. Ed's point, I want to just make sure that I understand his point. I agree that raising gas taxes will hurt a lot of people. Okay, I understand that. There's no one I want to hurt less than poor middle-class people who are striving to do the work in this country. They're the people who are working hard, striving to make a living. That's why I would make sure the gas tax is revenue neutral. Give it back. And the best way I give it back is I would cut Social Security taxes. Those are taxes paid primarily by the poor and middle class, not by the wealthy. If we were to cut those taxes, okay, and then people don't pay any more. They end up with the same revenue, but maybe they would use gas just a little bit less, and maybe we'd rely on terrorism just a little bit less. That's my idea, crazy as it may sound. If you didn't get a chance to comment and you want to, comment on my blog. It's really growing. I like to see all those comments. RadioInsideScoop.com. Add your words. And, hey, you know, someone else will respond. That's the way it works in America. Free speech. Give your views. This is Mark Levine signing off until tomorrow.